If our listeners want some free listening time, where should they go?
So our music is on all streaming platforms as Calico, all capital letters, and you can find us on Spotify, YouTube, Facebook, Amazon Music, SoundCloud, and Napster, to name a few. You can also find us on Instagram at calico.music. And yeah, we look forward to visiting Montreal and playing for you live one day.
Well, thank you for your interview today.
Thank you. Thanks for
having
us. Thank
you so much. Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to Tony and Chris speaking about their music and their dog, Sallow. I am your host, Sheila Ferrando.
You're listening to Radio CKUT 90.3 FM Montreal or online at ckut.ca.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Joe Biden has wrapped up a NATO summit in Brussels, Belgium, ahead of a highly anticipated meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Geneva Wednesday. As talks wrapped up, China accused NATO of adopting a Cold War mentality after Biden successfully pushed the military alliance to declare China a security risk for the first time. NATO leaders also criticized Russia and called on Moscow to withdraw troops from Ukraine, Georgia, and the Republic of Moldova. Later in the broadcast, we'll speak with historian Stephen Wertheim. The World Health Organization warned Monday the coronavirus is spreading faster than the global distribution of vaccines. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus was responding to a pledge by leaders of G7 to donate 1 billion vaccine doses to middle and low-income countries. That's just 613 million new doses on top of previously pledged aid.
This is a big help, but we need more, and we need them faster. More than 10,000 people are dying every day. During this press conference alone, more than 420 people will die. These communities need vaccines, and they need them now. Not next year.
The World Health Organization says 11 billion doses are needed to fully vaccinate 70% of the world's population. COVID-19 infections are surging in at least 14 African nations, where confirmed cases rose by 26% in the first week of June. Just 0.6% of Africa's 1.3 billion people are fully vaccinated. Chile has ordered millions of residents of the capital, Santiago, back into lockdown as intensive care units near capacity. That's despite South America's most successful vaccination program, which has fully vaccinated nearly 60% of Chileans. Brazil's opened the Copa America soccer tournament despite one of the world's worst COVID outbreaks. Brazil's health ministry has identified more than 40 COVID cases connected with Copa America, including 31 players or staff. As the tournament kicked off in Brasilia Sunday, indigenous people marched in protest.
We see the Copa America as an affront to the 500,000 deaths due to the misgovernance of this fascist government, which denied the vaccine to the Brazilian population, denied the vaccine to us indigenous peoples.
The United States death toll from COVID-19 has topped 600,000, even as the number of daily deaths fell to its lowest level since the pandemic was declared in March of last year. That's the highest official death toll of any country in the world, though disease experts at the University of Washington estimate the true U.S. death toll is over 924,000. On Monday, Vice President Kamala Harris traveled to South Carolina to kick off her tour promoting vaccinations in southern states, several of which have vaccination rates under 50%.
If you are vaccinated, you are protected. If your community is vaccinated, COVID rates in your community will go down.
CDC data shows U.S. coronavirus hotspots are clustered in areas with lower vaccination rates. Meanwhile, Vermont's become the first state to administer at least one vaccine dose to over 80% of its eligible population. Vermont Governor Phil Scott Monday said he's lifting all remaining coronavirus restrictions.
Because it's safe to do so. And it's safe because Vermonters have done their part to keep the virus from spreading and stepping up to get vaccinated. In fact, no state in the nation is in a better position to do this than we are.
Former National Security Agency contractor Reality Winner was released from prison Monday into a halfway house where she'll serve the remaining 6 months of her sentence. Winner was arrested in 2017, sentenced to 5 years in prison under the Espionage Act for leaking classified government information about Russian interference in the 2016 election. Prosecutors say Winner received the longest sentence ever given by a federal court for unauthorized disclosure of government information to the press. After headlines, we'll speak with Winner's attorney. On Capitol Hill, three Senate Republicans voted with Democrats Monday to confirm Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. The court's widely seen as a stepping stone to a nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. Her confirmation came as Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said Republicans would refuse to confirm any of President Biden's nominees to the Supreme Court in 2024 should a vacancy open. McConnell spoke Monday with conservative talk radio host Hugh Hewitt.
I think it's highly unlikely. In fact, no, I don't think either party, if it controlled, if it were different from the president, would confirm a Supreme Court nominee in the middle of an election.
During the same interview, Senator McConnell hinted he would also stonewall a Biden Supreme Court nominee in 2023 should Republicans take control of the Senate. A Chicago police officer who joined the January 6 riot at the U.S. Capitol has been arrested, becoming the 465th person charged in connection with the insurrection. Officer Carol Cheswick wore a Chicago Police Department sweatshirt as he texted selfies of himself breaching the offices of Senator Jeff Merkley. Meanwhile, weapons maker Boeing has resumed major campaign contributions to three Republican Congress members who voted to overturn the official certification of 2020's Electoral College votes, Congressmember Jack Bergman, Vicky Hartzler, and Steve Scalise. Boeing briefly stopped campaign contributions in the wake of the January 6th insurrection. Georgia Republican Congressmember Marjorie Taylor Greene's apologized for equating mask mandates during the pandemic to the Holocaust, when over 6 million people, most of them Jewish, were murdered by Nazi Germany. But Greene refused to retract her statement comparing Democrats to Nazis. Her comments came after she toured the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. Monday. In West Virginia, the Poor People's Campaign led a moral march on Manchin in Charleston Monday, protesting Democratic Senator Joe Manchin's opposition to killing the filibuster. They also demanded Manchin reverse his opposition to the For the People Act, which would restore and expand the protections of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, gutted by the Supreme Court in 2013. This is Reverend William Barber, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign.
We ain't in this heat to play. Am I right about it? We not in these streets to play. We are here to bring street heat and moral heat to the legislative processes. The voices of the people in West Virginia will be heard. We are nonviolent, but we ain't playing. We will fight for the soul of this democracy, because wages are at stake, infrastructure is at stake, voting rights are at stake, and we will fight for this democracy.
Senators Bernie Sanders, Ed Markey, and other progressive lawmakers are rejecting a bipartisan infrastructure bill negotiated by Democrats Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, along with Republican Mitt Romney. The compromise package calls for $580 billion in new spending, which climate activists say is far short of what's needed to avert a climate catastrophe. Meanwhile, dozens of youth climate activists marched across the Golden Gate Bridge Monday, capping a 266-mile march across California to demand officials take real action on the climate crisis. The protesters ended their march at the San Francisco home of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. This is 17-year-old Emma Govea, a member of the Sunrise Movement, one of the leaders of the march.
They are not being brave, and they're not fighting hard enough for to keep the climate in this infrastructure bill, to fight for the boldest, most well-funded civilian climate corps possible. And we know, we understand the science. We know what is necessary. We are asking for their legislation to be at scale with the climate crisis. And frankly, everything that they're putting forward is too watered down. It's just not enough.
The protest came as California faces an historic drought, with firefighters preparing for a wildfire year they anticipate could rival last year's record-breaking season. In Rockton, Illinois, a massive fire at a chemical plant's continuing to burn for a second day amidst warnings of an unfolding environmental catastrophe. The Chemtool chemical plant northwest of Chicago erupted in flames Monday morning, billowing thick black smoke, prompting a mandatory evacuation order for all residents within 1 mile of the site. People within a 3-mile radius have been ordered to wear masks to avoid respiratory irritation. Rockton's fire chief said firefighters would allow the blaze to continue to burn for days in order to prevent hazardous runoff into the nearby Rock River. In Minneapolis, a driver slammed his car into a crowd of peaceful protesters who'd gathered Sunday at a vigil against police brutality, killing one person and injuring three others. The crash killed 31-year-old Diana Marie Erickson, a mother of two small daughters. Police arrested the driver, Nicholas Krause, on suspicion of vehicular homicide. He's a 35-year-old white man with a history of domestic violence and at least 5 convictions for driving while intoxicated. Protesters had gathered to demand justice for Winston Smith, a 32-year-old black father of 3, who was shot dead in Minneapolis June 3rd by members of a U.S. Marshals Fugitive Task Force. Minnesota officials said Smith fired a gun at officers who returned fire, striking him multiple times. Police say there's no evidence, so there's no video of Smith's killing. A woman who was a passenger in the car disputed the police account, saying through her attorneys that she never saw a gun on Smith and never saw one in his vehicle. In Burma, the trial against opposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi began Monday. She faces a range of charges that the UN and others have condemned as politically motivated, including illegally possessing walkie-talkies and violating a state secrets law, totaling up to 15 years in prison. Suu Kyi has been under house arrest since she and other officials were ousted in a February 1st military coup. A local rights group says over 800 people have been killed, 4,300 arrested since the mass protests erupted in response to the coup. And the International Criminal Court seeking authorization from the Hague Tribunal to open investigation into possible crimes against humanity committed as part of Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte's brutal war on drugs. The crimes include murder, torture, and serious physical and mental harm. Since 2016, Duterte's war on drugs has claimed thousands of lives, including children. This is Nermita Lopez, the mother of one of the victims. Her 23-year-old son was killed in May 2017 for allegedly resisting arrest during a sting operation.
Yun, narinig ko yung balita tungkol sa ICC.
When I heard the news about the International Criminal Court, I was happy. I thought the case would no longer prosper. If we filed the case against Duterte here, nothing would happen. Since he is the president, he can manipulate everything. He can do anything to avoid getting sued and imprisoned. When I heard the news about the ICC, I became more hopeful.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.
Thank you.
Welcome back to CKUT. It's time for a little weather. Wednesday will be mainly sunny with a high of 22 degrees Celsius. Thursday will be sunny with a high of 24 degrees Celsius. Friday will bring a mix of sun and clouds and a high of 27 degrees Celsius. Saturday there will be rain and a high of 23 degrees Celsius. Sunday there will be the chance of a shower and a high of 25 degrees Celsius. Monday brings a mix of sun and clouds and a high of 26 degrees Celsius. And Tuesday there will be the chance of a shower and a high of 24 degrees Celsius.
I want to be more than just a girl you bring home. I want to be more than all the ones before. I want to be more than a drink or two. I want to be more to you. I want to be more than as you get lost in. I want to be more than just a friend. I want to be more than the butterfly eats. I want to be more than what you ever thought. You found, I wanna be more like that. Something sent from above. I wanna be more like that. Once in a lifetime kind of love. I wanna be more love. I wanna be more. I wanna be more than a diamond on a ring. I wanna be more. Love song you sing. I wanna be more than the sunshine in your day. I wanna be more than just a little company. I wanna be more like that. Something sent from above. I wanna be more like that. Once in a life. Once in a lifetime, kind of love. I wanna be more love. I wanna be more. I wanna be more. Wanna be more. Wanna be more. Wanna be more. Wanna be
like the world's going right, and I will think on words left unsaid when I'm left with my thoughts in the night. But you keep me in your arms, embracing the fear that I've held in my heart, and oh, your love, it keeps erasing the doubt that would keep us apart. Cause when you church at the top of the hill, I vowed that I would love you always, through the ups and the downs and the spills. So when our road seems to fade, or we lose our way, or we come to a standstill, oh, I'll take myself back to the church at the top of the hill. The honeymoon is short-lived, and a lifetime to get. top of the hill. Friday at the church at the top of the hill. I don't know why you chose to love me, but I know that you always will. So when our road seems to fade, or we lose our way, or we come to a standstill, oh, I'll take myself back to the church at the top of the hill.
From the corners of the hills, you can hear the blue jay's song, and the stream sustains the sound like the memory. Trees may whisper gentler too, as we watch the storm clouds gather over pastures.
Montreal. My name is Naomi Murney. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning After Show. And a rare known fact about the name Persephone, the ancient Greek goddess of spring, is that her name actually means bringer of death. So as spring comes into full bloom in the month of June, we're dedicating this entire episode to death, and more specifically, grief. If this is a difficult subject of discussion, as it is for many, feel free to tune in at another time or join us next week. Today, I'll be interviewing my friend and classmate Dana Prather and her friend and co-writer Rosemary Morrison about their new pod play, Good Grief, produced by the Downstage Theatre in Calgary. Dana and Rosemary wrote, directed, and acted in the production, which will be available starting June 17th. The play tackles grief from a young person's perspective. The writers wanted to approach the show with a messy personal authenticity, including personal anecdotes, despair, humor, and healing. I'll let them take it away.
I'm Dana Prather. I use she, her pronouns, but really whatever you want to roll with is fine. And as far as what I do in terms of our show, Good Grief, is I co-created and co-performed the show as well as helping produce and sort of self-directing.
Yeah, and I'm Rosemary Morrison. I also use she, her pronouns, but I'm not really that particular. And I did all the same things as Dana. We co-wrote it, co-produced it, co-performed it. Co all the things. Yeah, so Good Grief is essentially an exploration for Dana and I through grief. And we wanted to play with comedy as well as sharing our own personal stories. So Good Grief is just kind of about learning to grieve and all the different aspects of it.
Yeah, I think you put it perfectly. We really wanted to be able to explore these issues of grief without it feeling like us hitting you over the head with sadness for a half hour. Because we both have pretty morbid senses of humor a lot of the time. So we really want to incorporate that. And I think a lot of people do when it comes to grief, because it's how you deal and it's how you process. So we wanted to incorporate a few more laughs in there. So
that's really wonderful. And I think a great approach. Out of interest, is it two characters or do you folks play multiple characters and like multiple scenes?
We're actually, because this is our stories and us telling our own perspectives of grief and sort of learning from it, we are sort of playing versions of ourselves.
Yeah, the characters are essentially Dana and myself in some funky situations.
So from what I get, Dana, this isn't your first time directing. Rosemary, is this your first time directing?
Yes, I wouldn't consider this like a directing situation. The way that we sort of worked in rehearsal was we had a dramaturg and kind of did more of a collaborating thing. We didn't essentially have like a director. So like yes and no. As for writing, though, I have been a part of like writing for devised pieces. So the way that I've learned to write is writing like a bunch of separate pieces inspired by different things and then putting them all together. And we kind of took that process of writing and applied it to Good Grief, and it ended up working pretty well for us.
Could you go maybe a little bit more in depth into what the writing process looks like, especially for somebody who's listening and maybe doesn't know what a devised piece is?
Yeah.
And also, how was it writing for a pod play or an audio project rather than maybe a stage production?
Yeah. So devising it as a theater concept is essentially like, the way I like to think of it is brainstorming a whole bunch is as many ways as possible, and then taking the best things that you come up with and then putting those together into your puzzle that you're building. So When Dana and I wrote Good Grief, we started by just doing general concept brainstorming. What's the show going to be about? What are we inspired by? What are the things that we really want to hit in this show? And then we just did a whole bunch of generating writing. So we would write little monologues, little scenes, just a whole bunch of different things in one document. And then we created a separate document that would be the draft script. And so we would take little pieces of the like brain dump document, as we called it, and would take those little pieces and then start to put that together into a script.
And as far as writing specifically for an audio piece, we didn't know this was going to be an audio piece at the start. When we first signed on with Downstage Theater in Calgary, it was in the fall of 2019. We were supposed to have this show go up in May of 2020. And as I'm sure you can figure out why that didn't happen in person. So we had to pivot, and right around March 2020, when everything was just going crazy, we just decided to see what the world would look like in the future. And by the time it came to around winter of 2020, we decided, look, we don't know what's going to happen. Let's make this an audio piece so that whatever the world looks like, we can share it with people.
That's really interesting. So this has been a production kind of in the works for almost 2 years, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could I ask, how has it changed, and has it changed as time has gone on? And maybe there have been more encounters with grief, or kind of the COVID situation has been getting better. How has your script changed in response to that, if it has?
Yeah, well, it's been evolving this entire time. So it's been slowly changing no matter what. And as you mentioned, with the audio aspect, that it sort of changed the setting and the way that we delivered it. But I think the most important thing that will change through the pandemic and the way that it's been developing over 2 years is its effect on the audience, because all of a sudden grief was like so much more relevant because of the pandemic. And so I'm really thankful for that in a way, that it kind of lined up in that way. And I hope that when audiences hear it, we get that response still, and that it feels timely without feeling like a play that talks just about the pandemic a bunch, because we already saw enough of those. Yeah.
So what was the kind of impetus? How did you guys come up with this idea?
So originally, what started, we always wanted to do a show together. We knew that pretty quickly from when we met in high school, and just creating together, we work super well together in a very collaborative way. And the opportunity presented itself. I took a gap year between going to university and graduating from high school. And so I had some free time in the city, and Downstage Theater was starting up the Stage It program, where they were offering a budget, mentorship, and producing help, and a place to put your show. All you had to do was just submit some things. And at the time, I think we were the only team that came in with no ideas except, we want to do a show about grief. We want to devise it. That's our plan. Everyone else had scripts. They had script plans and directing ideas. And we just knew we wanted to create something together. So I think by not having a plan, but having our own experiences with grief and knowing we wanted to share them, because it's such a universal experience, it really allowed us to grow and change with everything that happened and not feel like we were stuffed into a box from 2 years ago.
That's great to hear. So could I also, I know it sounds very repetitive saying that's great after you guys talk about like grief and sadness and struggling. Like, that's awesome. So my next question was, why were you interested in tackling grief specifically?
Well, Dana and I both have a lot of experience with grief, especially for young people. Myself, for example, I lost my mother when I was 13 years old. And that's, you know, a pretty intense thing to deal with as a child. And learning to grieve as a young person is weird, because there's so much expectation and people are watching you, and like people are not comfortable with children grieving. So having as much experience with grief as we had for young people, we figured, you know, like we had something to say about it. You know, we had the experiences, we had the things to share, and we had a more like realistic view of grief than the sort of performative aspect that people often expect of you.
I think that's perfectly put. I mean, I think the thing you really hit the nail on the head with that we really wanted to drive home is that grief is uncomfortable and it makes a lot of people uncomfortable, but it's something that whether you've been through it before or not, everyone will go through in this lifetime. And is one of the only truly, truly universal experiences in human nature, I think, where no matter who you are, how rich you are, what demographic you are, you will have to deal with this at some point. And I think the more comfortable we can make people with it and letting people laugh at it and absorb it and process it, the better we all will be.
I guess another question is, when you're exploring grief in a kind of theatrical production or when you're presenting it to other people, you know, whether in an audio format or on a stage, how do you separate your own self from kind of what you're presenting? How do you not, well, essentially when you're talking about grief, and from what I hear, kind of these characters are based off of yourselves, there's a certain level of vulnerability. How do you separate yourself from that, you know, and do you, for sort of like sense of protection?
Definitely. This is something we talked a lot about. Having worked on productions before, we knew that sometimes it's an expectation in theater that you mine your trauma for art. And we didn't want that to be this. We wanted it to be healing and not feel like we had to dig up old wounds just to make something beautiful. So we talked a lot about checking in. So every rehearsal we would check in, we would say how we're feeling, and we check out once we're done. And if at any point we were going through a extra rough scene or extra rough moment, we would check in and say, hey, this is what I need at this time. Maybe I need a little more space. Maybe I need a little more support in this moment. And because we had such a wonderful team between the two of us and our wonderful dramaturg, Lauren Hahn, and our sound designer and audio engineer, Liz Page, wonderful team of women that were so supportive. And we all really are friends. So I think that helps a lot, just to have that system of support behind you so you don't feel like you have to rip your heart out in order to be vulnerable.
Yeah, yeah. And I think like what was helpful for us as well is to have this script laid out and sort of know what we're going to be presenting. And like Dina mentioned, there is an expectation of like what you call trauma mining. And we decided in our rehearsals that like there's no need to go all the way into those emotions every time you do this scene. But I think to a certain degree, you can't separate yourself from the character because this is our story. And so in order to do that in a healthy way, like Dina said, healing, you do have to feel it to a certain extent. You know, that's our whole philosophy on grieving is you have to do it. You have to feel it, but to do it in a healthy and healing and supportive environment where it's going to be okay. And it's not going to be just violent and bad. It was really, really important to us.
Thank you for a very honest answer. You both mentioned that comedy plays sort of a role in the writing and in this play. I think I kind of understand that whenever you're dealing with grief or impending grief or some sort of loss, there's kind of an inherent push towards comedy for some people, but there's also a certain hesitation. And how do you balance that? Or are you ever worried that grief being at once such a subjective and universal experience, that kind of, how do you tackle it?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, we've talked about this sort of expectation of grief. And I think this often comes from an older generation, you know, like a more, there is a traditional way to grieve, and it is a very specific, you go through the steps of grieving, you cry when you should cry, and there's all of these things that you should do to grieve. And I think a big thing for Dana and I was, you don't do that. That's not true. That's not real. People laugh. People make bad jokes. People make dark, uncomfortable jokes just because, you know, they're not sure what else to do. And that's okay. And I think because that's such a big thing for us, like, we just wanted to put that in there. And honestly, it's fairly unapologetic. Like, that's the part of like pushing for real grief, pushing for what's real and honest to you. We're going to make jokes. I'm going to make jokes about my dead mom. And honestly, there is nothing you can do about it.
Definitely. Yeah, I think it's just sort of the process of owning what happened to you or what's going to happen to you and the people in your lives and how you love them is you probably didn't love them crying all the time. You had laughter, and that's not just going to go away because someone dies. We'll make dead mom jokes. We'll make dead friend and dead grandpa jokes because sometimes that's what you need to process it. And other times we'll sit with it and we'll cry because that's just the human way of dealing with it. And to say otherwise, I think like Rosemary was saying, is really to try to fit people into the stages of grief with the ultimate idea of acceptance and moving on. But something we tackle a lot in this show is that, is there any truly moving on, or are you just learning to live with it and to carry it with you?
So I think I kind of asked about this previously, but when you're putting on a production on stage, there's kind of a lot of aspects that help you in your storytelling: costume, scenery, lighting, stage management, organization, blocking, choreography, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, buzzwords. But when you're producing an audio project or a pod play, it's like you're stripped of a lot of those. So how has that adaptation process been like? And maybe what have you learned? Or like how does the audio format even maybe help you tell your story?
Yeah, I think even you hearing you say those buzzwords made my heart so happy of thinking of like how close we are to getting back to like in-person theater is so wonderful. But in planning the show as an in-person piece, we had so many of those pieces. We had costume designs in the works and bits of how we wanted to stage things because we were doing all of that stuff ourselves, and it'd be Rosemary and I just going back and forth about what we wanted to see on stage. And pivoting to the audio format, obviously, like you said, you lose all of that, but as well, you gain a sense of intimacy that I think you can't get any other way than being that voice in people's ears. So I think it's really a give and take of that.
Yeah. It's understanding that it's different than a stage play. It's like, for us, we had to be like, okay, like this is an audio thing now, let's shift it. And then like our sound designer / audio engineer / sound sorceress, as we call her, became super, super important to us because now we need sound. Now we need to get our voices right and we need to have these microphones, and it's a different world and has lots of different aspects in it where we gained a bunch of things, as Dana said. And so it was just learning to start working in a whole different medium. And now we're going to be able to, now you can take our show with you. You could like walk around the block and just listen to it instead of having to go at, you know, one night. You can listen to it as many times as you want. It's just like a whole different world while still being in the world of theater.
That's very cool. And props to you guys for adapting, because it can be very hard. Sort of out of personal interest, do you have any kind of audioscapes? Like, have you tried to create some sort of audio landscapes for different scenes? Or is that...
yeah, definitely. That's much more of a Liz Page, as Rosemary was saying, our wonderful sound sorceress question, where she's been so wonderful. Even she was still our sound designer, even back 2 years ago, she signed on to the project and would send clips and pieces of these beautiful soundscapes where she was just said, put them anywhere, put them where you want. And shifting to an audio format, like Rosemary was saying, you really, sound becomes such a key player to make sure we're telling the story right and that it feels all-encompassing and real and immersive. So I'm so excited to see all of the things that she's cooked up. We've had a couple meetings and listened in, but we're really not getting the final product until another few days here. So I'm excited to see what those soundscapes have transformed into.
That's great to hear. I'm writing down Liz Page. If anyone's listening to this, go check out Liz Page. Hire Liz Page. I think three more questions for you. In terms of working together, kind of what have you learned and what have you gained and what are the struggles of collaborative theater making in general, maybe?
Yeah. I find that it is always helpful to have someone to bounce your ideas off of. There is no better way, for me at least, to get ideas going than to just start talking about them and throwing spaghetti at the Dana wall and seeing what sticks. And there are also, the challenges of living so far apart, being in different time zones. Dana was living in Montreal and I was living here in Burnaby, and we wrote so much of the play across a huge time difference across Turtle Island. And so that came with a lot of challenges. You know, sometimes the writing was disjointed, or sometimes we couldn't get in contact with each other, and sometimes just scheduling meetings was hard. But I think it's really special to co-create a piece and have being the parents of this little pod play child. It's nice. We share it. There's something great about sharing.
Absolutely. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Trying to schedule across time zones has been so hard, but I also think there's a benefit to that, of that sort of collaborative nature. Being so far apart is that because we're such good friends, often we would mix hanging out with our good grief time to work on the show. And so they kind of blend together and it'd be hard to keep track of where we are in the creative process. Whereas with this, we would know, okay, if we're blocking off an hour to work on Good Grief, we both have tight schedules. We're working on Good Grief for that hour, whenever that might be. And then we can hang out at a different hour. So I think it's really helped us stay organized in that respect.
You said that this is a play that you can kind of have in your pocket, like a pocket play, like you can listen to it. What is the ideal place to listen to this play? Like by a river, in a park, on a roller coaster with a friend, in an ice cream parlor?
That's such a great question.
I would say, okay, here's what I would say. If you want to get the most out of the grieving aspect of it, if you are someone who has lost someone or has experienced a serious loss, taking it to those places, there's always those places, the places you used to go with them, the places where you have the strongest memories. If you want to get the most out of the show, that is the way to do it. If you want to do it in a way where you're sure you're going to be emotionally safe and sound and feel better, I'd say listen in bed with some tissues and some ice cream and pajamas. Dana, other places?
I think in bed with some ice cream sounds wonderful. I think I'm going to listen to it outside. I think that would lend a whole other aspect of hearing the birds or the trees or wherever you are, maybe the traffic. Wherever it just feels comfortable and safe for you, because it is, well, it is a comedy. It's a lot to hear about grief for a half an hour, and we try our best to take care of you and make sure that you are well taken care of and just held right with your grief, I guess. I don't know how else to say it, but just making sure that you feel safe and comfortable while this is happening.
Thank you for a very lovely answer. So say that I listen to this and I'm good grief sounds so good. I have a free moment in this upcoming week. What are the dates of your show and where can I find tickets?
Good Grief runs June 17th to June 27th. You can find tickets. We have an Eventbrite page, so you can find them either via our Instagram, which has the link in there, or you can go to downstage.ca, and on their Stage It page of the website, you'll see Dana and Rosemary, and you'll see Good Grief, and there'll be a little button where you can click to go get tickets, and then that'll also take you to our Eventbrite page. And once you get to the Eventbrite page, there are pay what you can tickets, and then with a pay what you can ticket, you get access to the show. You can listen to it unlimited times between the 17th and the 27th. And then we also offer an add-on if you would like to talk about that, Dana.
Absolutely. So we wanted to do the pay what you can tickets because obviously theater is so expensive sometimes and it's really inaccessible. So we wanted anyone who wants to see the show, or I guess hear the show, can hear the show. And with the add-on, we wanted to make it a bit more interactive in this audio format. So with the add-on, which just covers the cost of postage and stationery, you get sent a letter and a prompt from the show, and you get to talk a bit about your experience with grief, if that's something you want, whether that's, even if you haven't lost someone, I think most people have experienced some kind of grief, whether it's breaking up with someone, or for me, I know when I was little, I cried over the fact that I let my Nintendogs die after a couple days. Whatever your grief is, we welcome you to write about it, say as much or as little as you want, and then send it back to us, and we're going to make a visual art display with it in Olympic Plaza in Calgary, Alberta.
And that was our interview with Dana Prather and Rosemary Morrison on their play Good Grief, which will be available from June 17th through to June 27th. For more information and to purchase tickets, you can find them at goodgrief2021_ on Instagram. Again, that's goodgrief2021_ in one word. And that's it for this Wednesday Morning After. This episode featured music sampled from the song Chosen by musician Blood Orange and the song The Cascades by the Fleet Foxes. My name is Naomi Murney, with audio editing done by Matthew Jackson. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, and it's been my pleasure to host today. Thank you for tuning in.
Well, that wraps up the show for today. Keep listening to CKUT. Thank you.
16 juin 2021, la 104e émission du Sleepy King Radio avec votre animateur Benoît Chaput.
Welcome to the kingdom of love, alleluia. Honor to the king and the queen, alleluia. Alleluia, alleluia. On the cieli Pompei, 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 Petano. Pompei, 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 Pompei